Today is Thursday, July 29th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. condemns growing attacks on civilians by the Taliban.
We've also seen these reports of atrocities committed by the Taliban in areas that it's taken over that are deeply, deeply troubling.
Plus, U.S. Senate begins crafting bipartisan infrastructure bill.
After months of private talks among a bipartisan group of senators, the Senate finally voted Wednesday night to begin work on a nearly $1 trillion national infrastructure plan.
Also, thousands of Ethiopian refugees flee into Sudan amid intense clashes. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken says Taliban attacks on civilians as U.S. troops pull out of Afghanistan are deeply troubling. In New Delhi, on Wednesday, for talks with Indian leaders, Blinken warned that if the fighters take control and commit atrocities, the country will become a pariah. He said the only path to peace in Afghanistan was through negotiations, which all parties must take seriously. Taliban insurgents have swept through several districts across Afghanistan and seized vital border control points in recent weeks as Washington withdraws its troops after 20 years. The Pentagon estimates the Taliban control more than half of Afghanistan's district centers.
What we're seeing in the last week is the Taliban making advances on district centers, challenging some provincial capitals. We've also seen these reports of atrocities committed by the Taliban in areas that it's taken over that are deeply, deeply troubling. They certainly do not speak well to the Taliban's intentions for the country as a whole. The Taliban says that it seeks international recognition. It wants international support for Afghanistan. Presumably, it wants its leaders to be able to travel freely in the world, sanctions lifted, etc. Well, taking over the country by force and abusing the rights of its people is not the path to achieve those objectives. There's only one path, and that's at the negotiating table to resolve the conflict peacefully and to have an Afghanistan emerge that is governed in a genuinely inclusive way and that's representative of all its people.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Senior Chinese diplomat Wang Yi met with representatives of the Taliban on Wednesday in the northern Chinese city of Tianjin, China's foreign ministry said on Wednesday. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
As American forces and their NATO allies withdraw from Afghanistan, Chinese officials are meeting representatives of the Taliban, who they say will play a, quote, important role in Afghanistan's future. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, met the nine-person delegation in the Chinese city of Tianjin. Foreign ministry spokesperson Chao Li-tian.
Wang Yi pointed out that the Afghan Taliban is a pivotal military and political force in Afghanistan. It's expected to play an important role in peaceful reconciliation and reconstruction in Afghanistan.
Taliban delegations have also visited Iran and Russia in recent weeks. It comes as the group has seized several districts across Afghanistan and reports of escalating attacks on civilians. This was U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on a trip in India Wednesday.
The Taliban says that it seeks international recognition, that it wants international support for Afghanistan. Presumably, it wants its leaders to be able to travel freely in the world, sanctions lifted, etc. Taking over the country by force and abusing the rights of its people is not the path to achieve those objectives. There's only one path, and that's at the negotiating table to resolve the conflict peacefully and to have an Afghanistan emerge that is governed in a genuinely inclusive way, and that's representative of all its people.
Afghanistan shares a border with both China and Iran. As the security situation worsens there, peace talks in Qatar's capital have made little progress.
That's Soraya Ali of Reuters. China's new ambassador to Washington, Qin Gang, on Wednesday wished the United States achieves victory against COVID-19. He also said great potential awaits their relations, striking an optimistic tone as he arrived at his new post amid deeply strained ties. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
China's new ambassador to the U.S., Qin Gang, on Wednesday expressed optimism about his country's relations with Washington. He hoped for America's swift recovery from COVID-19 and said the two countries have great potential for working together.
I firmly believe that the door of China-U.S. relations, which is already open, cannot and should not be closed. This is the trend of the world, the call of the times, and the will of the people.
Qin is replacing Cui Tengkai, China's longest-serving ambassador to the U.S. He stepped down last month after 8 years. Qin did two stints as a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman between 2006 and 2014. He earned a reputation for pointed public defenses of his country's positions. Qin's remarks come days after talks between Chinese and American diplomats ended in tension. Washington and Beijing signaled concessions had to be made on both sides in order to move forward with any talks. U.S.-China relations had faltered drastically under former President Donald Trump. The post of the U.S. ambassador to China hasn't been filled since last year, when Republican Terry Branstad stepped down to help with Trump's re-election campaign. Biden has yet to nominate a replacement, though foreign policy circles consider Nicholas Burns, a former ambassador to NATO, a favorite.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. The Senate votes to start work on a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
On this vote, the yeas are 67, the nays are 32.
After months of private talks among a bipartisan group of senators, the Senate finally voted Wednesday night to begin work on a nearly $1 trillion national infrastructure plan. Members of the negotiating group expressed joy and optimism.
This will be the greatest investment in infrastructure in all of our lifetimes.
This is truly a night to celebrate.
Infrastructure is about bringing America together.
But hard work lies ahead, and the fate of the deal is far from certain, in part because President Joe Biden and Democrats are also working on a separate, broader $3.5 trillion package that's being considered under budget rules. That maneuver would allow Vice President Kamala Harris to cast the deciding vote in event of a tie in the 50-50 Senate. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Protesters in Ethiopia's Somali region, angry at a deadly attack that has been blamed on a militia from neighboring Afar, have reportedly blocked a vital trade corridor. It's the last example of how simmering ethnic and regional tensions threaten to destabilize the country. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Hundreds of people took to the streets in Jigjiga, capital of Ethiopia's Somali region, on Wednesday, angry about a deadly weekend attack on a Somali town. The local government says a militia from neighbouring Afar was responsible and that hundreds of civilians were killed. It's the latest flare-up of a local boundary dispute and an example of the numerous ethnic tensions in Africa's second most populous country. Since taking office in 2018, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been trying to unify Ethiopia, a country of more than 80 ethnic groups. But he's struggled to contain a surge in violence as regions and ethnic groups vied for more power or settled old scores. The most deadly bloodshed has been in the Tigray region, where war broke out between the central government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front last November. That conflict has recently spread into Tigray's neighbouring Amhara and Afar regions, threatening further destabilisation. Back in Somali, the region's president, Mustafa Mohamed Omar, said on Wednesday that youths protesting Saturday's attack had blocked a vital road and rail trade artery. It links the capital Addis Ababa to the seaport of Djibouti, and according to a 2018 United Nations report, 95% of Ethiopia's imports are transported via that corridor. The reported blockage could not be independently verified. Abiy's office and authorities in Djibouti cannot be immediately reached for comment.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. Authorities in Sudan say at least 3,000 Ethiopian refugees fled into Sudan this week after the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region spread to the neighboring Amhara region. Naba Mohideen speaks to a refugee camp director and a political analyst about the significance of the influx in this report from Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities reported thousands of Ethiopian refugees crossing the border this week. In a phone interview with VOA, the head of Al-Gadarif Emergency Committee handling refugee camps, Al-Fatih Mugaddam, said the registered number of the new asylum seekers is 1,058. Mugaddam says the camps will struggle to absorb so many refugees, and he asked the Sudanese government and aid groups to quickly intervene. The majority of the new refugees fled from Ethiopia's Amharic region, bordering war-torn Tigray and the conflicted Al-Fashaga region between Sudan and Ethiopia. The war erupted in Ethiopia last November between the federal government in Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed accused Tigrayan troops of attacking federal military camps. The war in Ethiopia has caused a devastating humanitarian crisis, mostly in the Tigray region. Humanitarian aid agencies like the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, say more than 5 million people in the Tigray region are in urgent need of food aid. About 60,000 Ethiopians have fled to Sudan and are camping in the eastern cities bordering Ethiopia. Sudanese analysts like Ahmed Abdelghani warn the influx from the Amhara region might lead to tensions between Amharans and Tigrayans in the camps. Abdelghani says it's challenging because of the previous disputes between the two ethnic groups, with the Amharic group supporting the federal government of Ethiopia in its war against the Tigrayan people. He adds that receiving the new refugees in the same camps may cost Sudan a lot if the government didn't conduct security procedures to avoid any breakdown between the battling groups. The conflict in the Tigray region has worsened the already troubled relationship between Sudan and Ethiopia. The countries have engaged in a years-long dispute about Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric Gerd Dam, which Sudan and Egypt fear will cut off their access to adequate water from the Nile River. The Ethiopia government announced updated plans Tuesday for electricity generation from the dam after the second phase filling of the dam ended this month. Neba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
The Lebanese parliament designated former Prime Minister Najib Mikati to form a new government. He will be the third Lebanese politician to attempt that job since the explosion in the port city of Beirut a year ago that killed more than 200 people and forced the resignation of Prime Minister Hassan Diab. Imab Arab, Director of Research at the Arab Center in Washington, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shinawi about whether Mikati can handle the political division and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
You don't see him succeeding quickly. It's going to be very, very difficult for him to really try to form the government, fix basically what ails the Lebanese political system, and really address what is really turning out to be a disastrous situation in Lebanon. The Lebanese political system is very, very difficult to manage, very difficult to manipulate, and he comes in with not a whole lot of political power. There are other Sunni politicians who are more powerful than he is in the system, like Saad al-Hariri, who has just given up on forming the government. So I wish him luck, but I don't think he is going to be really very successful, at least for a few months.
Mikati faces another daunting challenge of fixing the disastrous economic situation in Lebanon. The World Bank has described the situation in Lebanon as one of the world's worst crises since the mid-19th century. Lebanon's currency has lost more than 90% of its value, and half of the population is living below the poverty line. What would it take for Mikati to ease this situation?
Well, it doesn't only take for Mikati to ease the situation. Mikati needs the full cooperation of the Lebanese political system and the Lebanese economic elites, and especially the banking sector. He has good relations with the banking sector, very good relations with the business community. But the problem is that the country itself does not necessarily have the necessary funding domestically to be able to launch a new economic endeavor, a new economic initiative. The country needs the international community to help bring in investments, help send in loans. The problem with all of this is that the international community is not necessarily very ready to help with this, specifically because the international community does not trust the Lebanese political system, does not trust the system itself and the institutions that are really rampant with corruption. So this is why Mikati's mission is almost impossible without the international support. The international support, however, requires that he form a credible government, a government that is not beholden to political interests, and a government that really has in its program a very, very clear plan on how to fight corruption and how to steady the Lebanese economy.
France is planning an international conference to aid Lebanon on August 4th. Would that help Lebanon get out of its ordeal?
Yes, it will. I think this is some sort of a humanitarian conference, a conference that helps the Lebanese deal with the humanitarian aspects of the current crisis. You know, any international community assistance, whether French or American or any other one from the United Nations or the international lending institutions, would be good for the Lebanese people. However, I'm afraid that this is only some sort of a temporary solution. It will help alleviate some humanitarian issues, but it's not long term. Lebanon needs its own economy to kick in, its own economy to be fixed, and it needs different economic sectors to really start producing and securing people's livelihoods.
That's Hassan Diab Imab Ab, Director of Research at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El Shenawi. The leader of Belarus's opposition told the Associated Press she hopes the United States and Europe will impose new sanctions on Belarus government enterprises to help lead the collapse of President Alexander Lukashenko's government. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the main opposition challenger to Lukashenko's in August disputed election, had several meetings in Washington District with administration officials and members of Congress. On Wednesday, she met with President Joe Biden, who spoke out for pro-democracy forces in Belarus. Lukashenko's government cracked down on the opposition after protests began when Lukashenko declared victory in the 2020 election. The opposition and Western governments denounced the vote as neither free nor fair. Japanese officials have sounded the alarm as Tokyo reported record-breaking coronavirus cases for the third straight day with the Olympics well underway. Chief Cabinet Secretary Katsunobu Kato told reporters the new cases are soaring not only in the Tokyo area but across the country. He says Japan has never experienced an expansion of the infections of this magnitude. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un says that prolonged lockdowns to prevent coronavirus has forced the country to face hardships, quote, no less harsh, unquote, than a wartime situation. Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters reports.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has made new comments on the country's fight against the coronavirus pandemic, acknowledging the struggle of its strict and prolonged lockdown. In a video aired by North Korea's state-run television, the leader says that the difficulties and hardship caused by the world health crisis, quote, are no less harsh for us than those in the wartime situation. He was making the speech to a veterans conference marking the 68th anniversary of the Korean War's armistice. While acknowledging the difficulty, he also said this generation will be victorious over COVID, just as the previous generation was victorious during the war. In June, Kim publicly reprimanded several top party officials for failures in the battle against COVID that he said put the country at risk, according to state media. He reportedly said at the time that the failings had created a major crisis.
That's Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters. Myanmar's military ruler is looking for greater cooperation with the international community to contain the coronavirus, state media reported on Wednesday. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Myanmar's military called for international help on Wednesday as the country battles a surging wave of COVID infections. It marks a shift in tone for the military, left largely isolated by the rest of the globe when they seized power in a coup earlier this year. The junta leader said vaccinations need to be increased and called for cooperation with fellow ASEAN and, quote, friendly countries. Nations including the US and Britain have slapped sanctions on the military rulers over the coup and repression of pro-democracy protesters. Efforts to contain the virus have been hampered by floods. In Karen State, bordering Thailand, photos reveal scenes of horror as healthcare workers wade through floodwaters, carrying patients on beds, weak and desperate for oxygen, or worried that staying at home could spread to other family members. The fast-growing outbreak amid ongoing chaos in the wake of the coup has exacerbated efforts by medics and funeral services working around the clock. The military has been wary of outside help in past disasters, forcing Myanmar's people to help each other. Though a previous administration did allow in aid via ASEAN after a devastating cyclone in 2008, only 3% of Myanmar's population are vaccinated, according to a Reuters tracker. 40,000 inmates in densely packed prisons are a major concern. The official infection number since June is nearly 5,000, but medics and funeral services say the actual infection and death toll is much higher. Myanmar's military has also arrested several doctors treating COVID-19 patients independently.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. The World Food Programme warns Yemen's already alarming hunger crisis is worsening due to ongoing conflict and a rapidly declining economy. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Food Programme warns Yemen's already alarming hunger crisis is worsening due to ongoing conflict and a rapidly declining economy that are sending food prices soaring. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Around 21 million people in Yemen need humanitarian assistance, this out of a population of just over 29 million. The United Nations, which considers Yemen the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, reports 16.2 million people are extremely short of food and suffering from acute hunger. Tobias Flamig is World Food Programme Head of Research, Assessment and Monitoring in Yemen. Speaking on a video link from the capital, Sana'a, he says people are resorting to desperate measures to survive. He says skyrocketing prices have made food unaffordable for millions of people. He says this is forcing many people to cut their food intake and eat only one meal a day.
A WFP team recently visited a village where families were resorting to eating leaves to survive. Traveling for work to reach markets or even seek medical care is almost impossible because the cost of fuel is too high. Hunger leaves people acutely vulnerable to the various public health risks facing the country, including COVID-19, cholera, dengue, and malaria.
The UN Children's Fund projects nearly 2.3 million children under age 5 will suffer from acute malnutrition in Yemen this year. Of these, it warns, some 400,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition could die if they do not receive urgent treatment. The World Food Programme estimates more than 5 million people in Yemen are on the brink of famine. Fleming says WFP has not yet declared a famine because specific evidence of food security, malnutrition, and mortality must be collected. This, he says, is difficult to do in a conflict zone.
The international community must not wait for such a classification in Yemen to act. People do not start dying when a declaration of famine is made. It is only their deaths that trigger a declaration.
WFP provides emergency food assistance to nearly 13 million people every month. The agency has increased food aid in all famine risk areas since the start of the year, as additional funds have become available. However, money remains in short supply. Consequently, cuts have had to be made, so 3 million beneficiaries are receiving food rations on alternate months instead of monthly. WFP requires $1.9 billion to run its humanitarian operation this year. It is $900 million short of this mark and is appealing to the international community to close this gap. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
I'm Carol Castiel. President Joe Biden believes it is growing more likely that the United States could end up in a real shooting war with a major power as a consequence of a cyber breach. so we will talk with cybersecurity and Russia specialist Tatiana Bolton about several global ransomware attacks and what we can do to thwart them. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice.